That ain't Arn. Well, maybe we could get a little piece of her. Maybe a little piece. Right down there, a patch. Jimson weed now. Christ, I could get enough potatoes off in that little patch to feed my whole family. It ain't Arn. It got to have Jimson weeds. Now and then a man tried, crept on the land and cleared a piece, trying like a thief to steal a little richness from the earth. Secret gardens hidden in the weeds, a package of carrot seeds and a few turnips, planted potato skins, crept out in the evening secretly to hoe in the stolen earth. Leave the weeds around the edge, then nobody can see what we're doing. Leave some weeds, big tall ones, in the middle. Secret gardening in the evenings, and water carried in a rusty can. And then one day, a deputy sheriff.
Well, what you think you're doing?
I ain't doing no harm.
I had my eye on you. This ain't your land. You're trespassing.
The land ain't plowed, and I ain't hurting it none. You goddamn squatters.
Pretty soon you'd think you owned it. You'd be sore as hell, think you owned it. Get off now.
And the little green carrot tops were kicked off, and the turnip greens trampled, and then the Jimson weed moved back in. But the cop was right. A crop raised, why, that makes ownership. Land hoed and the carrots eaten. A man might fight for land he's taken food from. Get him off quick. He'll think he owns it. He might even die fighting for the little plot among the Jimson weeds.
Did you see his face when we kicked them turnips out? Why, he'd kill a fella soon as he looked at him. We got to keep these here people down, or they'll take the country. They'll take the country.
Outlanders. Foreigners.
Sure, they talk the same language, but they ain't the same. Look how they live. Think any of us folks would live like that? Hell no.
In the evening, squatting and talking, and an excited man. Why don't 20 of us take a piece of land? We got guns. Take it and say, put us off if you can. Why don't we do that?
They just shoot us like rats.
Well, which you'd rather be, dead or here? Underground or in a house all made of gunny sacks? Which would you rather for your kids? Dead now or dead in 2 years from what they call malnutrition? Know what we ate all week? Biled nettles and fried dough. Know where we got the flour for the dough? Swept the floor of a boxcar. Talking in the camps, and the deputies, fat-assed men with guns slung on fat hips, swaggering through the camps.
Give 'em something to think about. Got to keep 'em in line, or Christ only knows what they'll do. Why, Jesus, they're as dangerous as niggers in the South. If they ever get together, there ain't nothing that'll stop 'em.
Quote, in Lawrenceville, a deputy sheriff evicted a squatter, and the squatter resisted, making it necessary for the officer to use force. The 11-year-old son of the squatter shot and killed the deputy with a .22 rifle.
Rattlesnakes. Don't take chances with them. And if they argue, shoot first. If a kid'll kill a cop, what'll the men do? Thing is, get tougher than they are. Treat 'em rough. Scare 'em.
What if they won't scare? What if they stand up and take it and shoot back? These men were armed when they were children. A gun is an extension of themselves. What if they won't scare? What if sometime an army of them marches on the land, as the Lombards did in Italy, as the Germans did on Gaul, and the Turks did on Byzantium? They were land-hungry, ill-armed hordes, too, and the legions could not stop them. Slaughter and terror did not stop them. How can you frighten a man whose hunger is not only in his own cramped stomach, but in the wretched bellies of his children? You can't scare him. He has known a fear beyond every other. In Hooverville, the men talking,
Grandpa took his land from the Injuns.
Now this ain't right. We're talking here. This here you're talking about is stealing. I ain't no thief.
No,
You stole a bottle of milk from a porch night before last, and you stole some copper wire and sold it for a piece of meat.
Yeah, but the kids was hungry.
It's stealing, though. Know how the Fairfield Ranch was got? I'll tell you. It was all government land and could be took up. Old Fairfield, he went into San Francisco to the bars, and he got him 300 stew bums. Them bums took up the land. Fairfield kept them in food and whiskey, and then when they'd proved the land, old Fairfield took it from him. He used to say the land cost him a pint of rot gut an acre. Would you say that was stealing? Well, it wasn't right, but he never went to jail for it. No, he never went to jail for it. And the fella that put a boat in a wagon and made his report like it was all underwater 'cause he went in a boat, he never went to jail neither. And the fellas that bribed congressmen and the legislatures never went to jail neither. All over the state, jabbering in the Hoovervilles. And then the raids, the swoop of armed deputies on the squatters' camps. Get out! Department of Health orders! This camp is a menace to health! Where are we gonna go? That's none of our business. We got orders to get you out of here. In half an hour, we set fire to the camp. There's typhoid down the line. You want to spread it all over? We got orders to get you out of here. Now get. In half an hour, we burn the camp. In half an hour, the smoke of paper houses, of weed-thatched huts, rising to the sky, and the people in their cars rolling over the highways, looking for another Hooverville. And in Kansas and Arkansas, in Oklahoma and Texas and New Mexico, the tractors moved in and pushed the tenants out. 300,000 in California and more coming. And in California, the roads full of frantic people running like ants to pull, to push, to lift, to work. For every manload to lift, 5 pairs of arms extended to lift it. For every stomach full of food available, 5 mouths open. And the great owners, who must lose their land in an upheaval, the great owners with access to history, with eyes to read history and to know the great fact, when property accumulates in too few hands, it is taken away. And that companion fact, when a majority of the people are hungry and cold, they will take by force what they need. And the little screaming fact that sounds through all history, repression works only to strengthen and knit the repressed. The great owners ignored the 3 cries of history. The land fell into fewer hands, the number of the dispossessed increased, and every effort of the great owners was directed at repression. The money was spent for arms, for gas to protect the great holdings, and spies were sent to catch the murmuring of revolt so that it might be stamped out. The changing economy was ignored, plans for the change ignored, and only means to destroy revolt were considered, while the causes of revolt went on. The tractors which throw men out of work, the belt lines which carry loads, the machines which produce, all were increased, and more families scampered on the highways looking for crumbs from the great holdings, lusting after the land beside the roads. The great owners formed associations for protection, and they met to discuss ways to intimidate, to kill, to gas. And always they were in fear of a principle. 300,000. If they ever move under a leader, the end. 300,000 hungry and miserable. If they ever know themselves, the land will be theirs, and all the gas, all the rifles in the world won't stop them. And the great owners, who had become through their holdings both more and less than men, ran to their destruction and used every means that in the long run would destroy them. Every little means, every violence, every raid on a Hooverville, every deputy swaggering through a ragged camp put off the day a little and cemented the inevitability of the day. The men squatted on their hams, sharp-faced men, lean from hunger and hard from resisting it, sullen eyes and hard jaws, and the rich land was around them.
Did you hear about the kid in that fourth tent down?
No, I just come in.
Well, that kid's been a crying in his sleep and a rolling in his sleep. Them folks thought he got worms, so they give him a blaster, and he died. It was what they call black tongue, the kid had. Comes from not getting good things to eat.
Poor little fella.
Yeah, but them folks can't bury him. Got to go to the county stone orchard.
Well, hell.
And hands went into pockets, and little coins came out. In front of the tent, a little heap of silver grew, and the family found it there. Our people are good people. Our people are kind people. Pray God someday kind people won't all be poor. Pray God someday a kid can eat. And the associations of owners knew that someday the praying would stop. And there's the end.
Chapter 20. The family on top of the load, the children and Connie and Rose of Sharon and the preacher, were stiff and cramped. They had sat in the heat in front of the coroner's office in Bakersfield while Pa and Ma and Uncle John went in. Then a basket was brought out and the long bundle lifted down from the truck, and they sat in the sun while the examination went on, while the cause of death was found and the certificate signed. Al and Tom strolled along the street and looked in store windows and watched the strange people on the sidewalks. And at last, Pa and Ma and Uncle John came out, and they were subdued and quiet. Uncle John climbed up on the load, Pa and Ma got in the seat, Tom and Al strolled back and Tom got under the steering wheel. He sat there silently, waiting for some instruction. Pa looked straight ahead, his dark hat pulled low. Ma rubbed the sides of her mouth with her fingers, and her eyes were far away and lost, dead with weariness. Pa sighed deeply.
"There wasn't nothing else to do," he said.
"I know," said Ma. "She would have liked a nice funeral, though. She always wanted one."
Tom looked sideways at them.
"County?"
he asked.
"Yep."
Pa shook his head quickly, as though to get back to some reality.
"We didn't have enough. We couldn't have done it."
He turned to Ma.
"You ain't to feel bad. We couldn't, no matter how hard we tried, no matter what we done. We just didn't have it. Embalming and a coffin and a preacher and a plot in a graveyard would have took 10 times what we got. We done the best we could."
"I know," Ma said. "I just can't get it out of my head what store she set by a nice funeral. Got to forget it."
She sighed deeply and rubbed the side of her mouth.
"That was a pretty nice fella in there. Awful bossy, but he was pretty nice."
"Yeah,"
Pa said.
"He give us a straight talk, all right."
Ma brushed her hair back with her hand. Her jaw tightened.
"We got to get," she said. "We got to find a place to stay. We got to get work and settle down. No use a-letting the little fellas go hungry. That wasn't never Grandma's way. She always ate a good meal at a funeral."
"Where are we going?" Tom asked.
Pa raised his hat and scratched among his hair.
"Camp," he said. "We ain't gonna spend what's little left till we get work. Drive out in the country."
Tom started the car and they rolled through the streets and out toward the country. And by a bridge, they saw a collection of tents and shacks. Tom said,
"Might's well stop here, find out what's doing and where at the work is."
He drove down a steep dirt incline and parked on the edge of the encampment. There was no order in the camp. Little gray tents, shacks, cars were scattered about at random. The first house was nondescript,
The south wall was made of 3 sheets of rusty, corrugated iron, the east wall a square of moldy carpet tacked between 2 boards, the north wall a strip of roofing paper and a strip of tattered canvas, and the west wall 6 pieces of gunny sacking. Over the square frame, on untrimmed willow limbs, grass had been piled, not thatched, but heaped up in a low mound. The entrance on the gunny sack side was cluttered with equipment. A 5-gallon kerosene can served for a stove. It was laid on its side with a section of rusty stovepipe thrust in one end. A wash boiler rested on its side against the wall, and a collection of boxes lay about, boxes to sit on, to eat on. A Model T Ford sedan and a 2-wheeled trailer were parked beside the shack, and about the camp there hung a slovenly despair. Next to the shack there was a little tent, gray with weathering, but neatly, properly set up, and the boxes in front of it were placed against the tent wall. A stovepipe stuck out of the door flap, and the dirt in front of the tent had been swept and sprinkled. A bucketful of soaking clothes stood on a box. The camp was neat and sturdy. A Model A roadster and a little homemade bed trailer stood beside the tent. And next there was a huge tent, ragged, torn in strips and the tears mended with pieces of wire. The flaps were up, and inside 4 wide mattresses lay on the ground. A clothesline strung along the side bore pink cotton dresses and several pairs of overalls. There were 40 tents and shacks, and beside each habitation some kind of automobile. Far down the line a few children stood and stared at the newly arrived truck, and they moved toward it, little boys in overalls and bare feet, their hair gray with dust. Tom stopped the truck and looked at Pa.
"She ain't very pretty," he said. "Want to go somewheres else?"
"Can't go nowheres else till we know where we're at," Pa said. "We got to ask about work."
Tom opened the door and stepped out. The family climbed down from the load and looked curiously at the camp. Ruthie and Winfield, from the habit of the road, took down the bucket and walked toward the willows where there would be water, and the line of children parted for them and closed after them. The flaps of the first shack parted and a woman looked out. Her gray hair was braided, and she wore a dirty, flowered Mother Hubbard. Her face was wizened and dull, deep gray pouches under blank eyes, and a mouth slack and loose. Pa said,
"Can we just pull up anywheres and camp?"
The head was withdrawn inside the shack. For a moment there was quiet, and then the flaps were pushed aside and a bearded man in shirt sleeves stepped out. The woman looked out after him, but she did not come into the open. The bearded man said,
"Howdy, folks,"
and his restless dark eyes jumped to each member of the family, and from them to the truck, to the equipment. Pa said,
"I just asked your woman if it's all right to set her stuff anywheres."
The bearded man looked at Pa intently, as though he had said something very wise that needed thought.
"Set down anywheres? Here in this place?"
he asked.
"Sure. Anybody own this place that we got to see before we can camp?"
The bearded man squinted one eye nearly closed and studied Pa.
"You wanna camp here?"
Pa's irritation arose. The gray woman peered out of the burlap shack.
"What you think I'm a-sayin'?" Pa said.
"Well, if you wanna camp here, why don't you? I ain't just stopping you."
Tom laughed.
"He got it."
Pa gathered his temper.
"I just wanted to know, does anybody own it? Do we got to pay?"
The bearded man thrust out his jaw.
"Who owns it?"
he demanded. Pa turned away.
"The hell with it,"
he said. The woman's head popped back in the tent. The bearded man stepped forward menacingly.
"Who owns it?"
he demanded.
"Who's gonna kick us out of here You tell me.
Tom stepped in front of Pa. You better go take a good long sleep, he said. The bearded man dropped his mouth open and put a dirty finger against his lower gums. For a moment he continued to look wisely, speculatively at Tom, and then he turned on his heel and popped into the shack after the gray woman. Tom turned on Pa.
What the hell was that? He asked.
Pa shrugged his shoulders. He was looking across the camp. In front of a tent stood an old Buick, and the head was off. A young man was grinding the valves, and as he twisted back and forth on the tool, he looked up at the Jode truck. They could see that he was laughing to himself. When the bearded man had gone, the young man left his work and sauntered over.
"How are you?" he said, and his blue eyes were shiny with amusement. "I seen you just met the mayor."
"What the hell's the matter with him?" Tom demanded. The young man chuckled.
"He's just nuts, like you and me. Maybe he's a little nutser than me, I don't know."
Pa said,
"I just asked him if we could camp here."
The young man wiped his greasy hands on his trousers.
"Sure, why not? You folks just come across?"
"Yeah," said Tom. "Just got in this morning."
"Never been in Hooverville before?"
"Where's Hooverville?"
"This here's her."
"Oh," said Tom. "We just got in."
Winfield and Ruthie came back, carrying a bucket of water between them. Ma said,
"Let's get the camp up. I'm tuckered out. Maybe we can all rest."
Pa and Uncle John climbed up on the truck to unload the canvas and the beds. Tom sauntered to the young man and walked beside him back to the car he had been working on. The valve-grinding brace lay on the exposed block, and a little yellow can of valve-grinding compound was wedged on top of the vacuum tank. Tom asked,
"What the hell was the matter with that old fellow with the beard?"
The young man picked up his brace and went to work, twisting back and forth, grinding valve against valve seat.
"The mayor? Christ knows. I guess maybe he's bull simple."
"What's bull simple?"
"I guess cops push him around so much he's still spinning."
Tom asked,
"Why would they push a fella like that around?"
The young man stopped his work and looked in Tom's eyes.
"Christ knows," he said. "You just come. Maybe you can figure out. Some fella says one thing, and some says another thing. But you just camp in one place a little while, and you see how quick a deputy sheriff shoves you along."
He lifted a valve and smeared compound on the seat.
"But what the hell for?"
"I tell you, I don't know. Some says they don't want us to vote. Keep us moving so we can't vote. And some says so we can't get on relief. And some says if we set in one place, we'd get organized. I don't know why. I only know we get rode all the time. You wait. You'll see."
"We ain't no bums," Tom insisted. "We're looking for work. We'll take any kind of work."
The young man paused in fitting the brace to the valve slot. He looked in amazement at Tom.
"Looking for work," he said. "So you're looking for work. What you think everybody else is looking for, diamonds? What you think I wore my ass down to a nub looking for?"
He twisted the brace back and forth. Tom looked about at the grimy tents, the junk equipment, at the old cars, the lumpy mattresses out in the sun, at the blackened cans on fire-blackened holes where the people cooked. He asked quietly,
"Ain't they no work?"
"I don't know. Must be. Ain't no crop right here now. Grapes to pick later and cotton to pick later. We're moving on as soon as I get these here valves ground, me and my wife and my kids. We heard they was work up north. We're shoving north up around Salinas."
Thank you.
Tom saw Uncle John and Pa and the preacher hoisting the tarpaulin on the tent poles and Ma on her knees inside, brushing off the mattresses on the ground. A circle of quiet children stood to watch the new family get settled, quiet children with bare feet and dirty faces. Tom said,
"Back home some fellas come through with handbills, orange ones. Says they need lots of people out here to work the crops."
The young man laughed.
"They say there's 300,000 of us folks here, and I bet every damn family seen them handbills."
"Yeah, but if they don't need folks, what'd they go to the trouble putting them things out for?"
"Use your head, why don't you?"
"Yeah, but I want to know."
"Look," the young man said, "suppose you got a job of work, and there's just one fella wants a job. You got to pay him what he asked. But suppose they's 100 men."
He put down his tool. His eyes hardened and his voice sharpened.
"Suppose there's 100 men wants that job. Suppose them men got kids, and them kids is hungry. Suppose a lousy dime will buy a box of mush for them kids. Suppose a nickel will buy them at least something for them kids. And you got 100 men? Just offer them a nickel. Why, they'll kill each other fighting for that nickel. Know what they was paying? Last job I had, 15 cents an hour. 10 hours for $1.50. And you can't stay on the place. Got to burn gasoline getting there."
He was panting with anger, and his eyes blazed with hate.
"That's why them handbills was out. You can print a hell of a lot of them handbills with what you save paying 15 cents an hour for field work."
Tom said,
"That's stinking."
The young man laughed harshly.
"You stay out here a little while, and if you smell any roses, you come let me smell, too."
"But they is work," Tom insisted. "Christ almighty, with all this stuff a-growing, orchards, grapes, vegetables, I seen it. They got to have men. I seen all that stuff."
A child cried in the tent beside the car. The young man went into the tent, and his voice came softly through the canvas. Tom picked up the brace, fitted it in the slot of the valve, and ground away, his hand whipping back and forth. The child's crying stopped. The young man came out and watched Tom.
"You can do her," he said. "Damn good thing. You'll need to."
"How about what I said?" Tom resumed. "I seen all the stuff growing."
The young man squatted on his heels.
"I'll tell you," he said quietly. "They's a big son of a bitch of a peach orchard I worked in. Takes 9 men all year round."
He paused impressively.
"Takes 3,000 men for 2 weeks when them peaches is ripe. Got to have 'em, or them peaches will rot. So what do? They send out handbills all over hell. They need 3,000 and they get 6,000. They get them men for what they want to pay. If you don't want to take what they pay, goddammit, there's 1,000 men waiting for your job. So you pick, and then she's done. Whole part of the country's peaches, all ripe together. When you get 'em picked, every goddamn one is picked. There ain't another damn thing in that part of the country to do. And then them owners don't want you there no more. 3,000 of you, the work's done. You might steal. You might get drunk. You might just raise hell. And besides, you don't look nice living in old tents, and it's a pretty country, but you stink it up. They don't want you around, so they kick you out. They move you along. That's how it is."
Tom, looking down toward the Jode tent, saw his mother, heavy and slow with weariness, build a little trash fire and put the cooking pots over the flame. The circle of children drew closer, and the calm, wide eyes of the children watched every move of Ma's hands. An old, old man with a bent back came like a badger out of a tent and snooped near, sniffing the air as he came. He laced his arms behind him and joined the children to watch Ma. Ruthie and Winfield stood near to Ma and eyed the strangers belligerently. Tom said angrily,
"Them peaches gotta be picked right now, don't they? Just when they're ripe?"
"Course they do."
"Well, suppose them people got together and says, Let 'em rot. Wouldn't be long before the price went up, by God.
The young man looked up from the valves, looked sardonically at Tom.
Well, you figured out something, didn't you? Come right out of your own head.
I'm tired, said Tom. Drove all night. I don't want to start no argument. And I'm so goddamn tired I'd argue easy. Don't be smart with me. I'm asking you.
The young man grinned.
I didn't mean it. You ain't been here. Folks figured that out, and the folks with the peach orchard figured her out, too. Look, if the folks gets together, they's a leader. Got to be. Fella that does the talking. Well, first time this fella opens his mouth, they grab him and stick him in jail. And if they's another leader pops up, why, they stick him in jail.
Tom said, well, a fella eats in jail anyways.
His kids don't. How'd you like to be in and your kids starving to death?
Yeah, said Tom slowly. Yeah.
And here's another thing. Ever hear of the blacklist?
What's that?
Well, you just open your trap about us folks getting together and you'll see. They take your picture and send it all over. Then you can't get work nowhere. And if you got kids...
Tom took off his cap and twisted it in his hands.
So we take what we can get, huh? Or we starve. And if we yelp, we starve.
The young man made a sweeping circle with his hand, and his hand took in the ragged tents and the rusty cars. Tom looked down at his mother again, where she sat scraping potatoes. And the children had drawn closer. He said,
I ain't gonna take it. God damn it, I and my folks ain't no sheep. I'll kick the hell out of somebody.
Like a cop?
Like anybody.
You're nuts, said the young man. They'll pick you right off. You got no name, no property. They'll find you in a ditch with the blood dried on your mouth and your nose. Be one little line in the paper. Know what it'll say? Vagrant found dead, and that's all. You'll see a lot of them little lines, vagrant found dead.
Tom said, there'll be somebody else found dead right alongside of this here vagrant.
You're nuts, said the young man. Won't be no good in that.
Well, what you doing about it?
He looked into the grease-streaked face, and a veil drew down over the eyes of the young man.
Nothing. Where you from?
Us? Right near Salisaw, Oklahoma.
Just get in?
Just today.
Gonna be around here long?
Don't know. We'll stay wherever we can get work.
Why? Nothing.
And the veil came down again.
Got to sleep up, said Tom. Tomorrow we'll go out looking for work.
You can try.
Tom turned away and moved toward the Jode tent. The young man took up the can of valve compound and dug his finger into it.
Hi,
he called. Tom turned.
What you want?
I want to tell you.
He motioned with his finger, on which a blob of compound stuck.
I just want to tell you, don't go looking for no trouble. Remember how that bull simple guy looked?
Fell in the tent up there?
Yeah, looked dumb, no sense.
What about him?
Well, when the cops come in, and they come in all the time, that's how you want to be. Dumb, don't know nothing, don't understand nothing. That's how the cops like us. Don't hit no cops. That's just suicide. Be bull simple.
Let them goddamn cops run over me and me do nothing?
No, look here. I'll come for you tonight. Maybe I'm wrong. There's stools around all the time. I'm taking a chance, and I got a kid, too. But I'll come for you. And if you see a cop, why, you're a goddamn dumb Okie. See?
That's all right if we're doing anything, said Tom.
Don't you worry. We're doing something. Only we ain't sticking our necks out. A kid starves quick. 2-3 days for a kid.
He went back to his job, spread the compound on a valve seat, and his hand jerked rapidly back and forth on the brace, and his face was dull and dumb. Tom strolled slowly back to his camp. "Bull simple," he said under his breath. Pa and Uncle John came toward the camp, their arms loaded with dry willow sticks, and they threw them down by the fire and squatted on their hams.
"Got her picked over pretty good," said Pa. "Had to go a long ways for wood."
He looked up at the circle of staring children.
"Lord God Almighty," he said, "where'd you come from?"
All of the children looked self-consciously at their feet.
"Guess they smelled the cookin'," said Ma. "Winfield, get out from underfoot."
She pushed him out of her way.
"Got to make us up a little stew," she said. "We ain't had nothing cooked right since we come from home. Pa, you go up to the store there and get me some neck meat. Make a nice stew here."
Pa stood up and sauntered away. Al had the hood of the car up, and he looked down at the greasy engine. He looked up when Tom approached.
"You sure look happy as a buzzard," Al said.
"I'm just gay as a toad in spring rain," said Tom.
"Look at the engine," Al pointed. "Pretty good, huh?"
Tom peered in.
"Looks all right to me."
"All right? Jesus, she's wonderful. She ain't shot no oil nor nothing."
He unscrewed a spark plug and stuck his forefinger in the hole.
"Crusted up some, but she's dry."
Tom said,
"You done a nice job of picking, that what you want me to say?"
"Well, I sure was scared the whole way, figuring she'd bust down and it'd be my fault."
"No, you done good. Better get her in shape, 'cause tomorrow we're going out looking for work."
"She'll roll," said Al. "Don't you worry none about that."
He took out a pocket knife and scraped the points of the spark plug. Tom walked around the side of the tent, and he found Casey sitting on the earth, wisely regarding one bare foot. Tom sat down heavily beside him.
"Think she's gonna work?"
"What?"
asked Casey.
"Them toes of yourn."
"Oh, just sitting here a-thinking."
"You always get good and comfortable for it," said Tom.
Casey waggled his big toe up and his second toe down, and he smiled quietly.
"Hard enough for a fellow to think thout kinking hisself up to do it."
"Ain't heard a peep out of you for days," said Tom. "Thinking all the time?"
"Yeah, thinking all the time."
Tom took off his cloth cap, dirty now and ruinous, the visor pointed as a bird's beak. He turned the sweatband out and removed a long strip of folded newspaper.
"Sweat so much she shrank," he said.
He looked at Casey's waving toes.
"Could you come down from your thinking and listen a minute?"
Casey turned his head on the stalk-like neck.
"Listen all the time. That's why I've been thinking. Listen to people a-talking. And pretty soon I hear the way folks are feeling. Going on all the time, I hear 'em and feel 'em. And they're beating their wings like a bird in an attic. Gonna bust their wings on a dusty window trying to get out."
Tom regarded him with widened eyes, and then he turned and looked at the gray tent 20 feet away. Washed jeans and shirts and a dress hung to dry on the tent guys. He said softly,
"That was about what I was gonna tell you, and you seen already."
"I seen," Casey agreed. "They's a army of us without no harness."
He bowed his head and ran his extended hand slowly up his forehead and into his hair.
"All along I seen it," he said. "Every place we stopped I seen it. Folks hungry for side meat, and when they get it, they ain't fed. And when they'd get so hungry they couldn't stand it no more, why, they'd ask me to pray for 'em, and sometimes I done it."
He He clasped his hands around drawn-up knees and pulled his legs in.
"I used to think that it cut her," he said. "Used to rip off a prayer and all the troubles would stick to that prayer like flies on flypaper. And the prayer'd go sailing off, a-taking them troubles along. But it don't work no more."
Tom said, "Prayer never brought in no side meat. Takes a shoat to bring in pork."
"Yep," Casey said. "And Almighty God never raised no wages. These here folks want to live decent and bring up their kids decent. And when they're old, they want to set in the door and watch the downing sun. And when they're young, they want to dance and sing and lay together. They want to eat and get drunk and work. And that's it. They want to just fling their goddamn muscles around and get tired. Christ, what am I talking about?"
"I don't know," said Tom. "Sounds kind of nice. When you think you can get to work and quit thinking a spell. We got to get work. Money's about gone. Pa give $5 to get a painted piece of board stuck up over Grandma. We ain't got much left."
A lean brown mongrel dog came sniffing around the side of the tent. He was nervous and flexed to run. He sniffed close before he was aware of the two men, and then looking up he saw them, leaped sideways and fled, ears back, bony tail clamped protectively. Casey watched him go, dodging around a tent to get out of sight. Casey sighed.
"I ain't doing nobody no good," he said. "Me or nobody else. I was thinking I'd go off alone by myself. I'm a-eatin' your food and a-takin' up room, and I ain't give you nothin'. Maybe I could get a steady job and maybe pay back some of the stuff you've give me."
Tom opened his mouth and thrust his lower jaw forward, and he tapped his lower teeth with a dried piece of mustard stalk. His eyes stared over the camp, over the gray tents and the shacks of weed and tin and paper.
"Wished I had a sack of Durham," he said. "I ain't had a smoke in a hell of a time. Used to get tobacco in McAllister. Almost wished I was back."
He tapped his teeth again, and suddenly he turned on the preacher.
"Ever been in a jailhouse?"
"Nope," said Casey. "Never been."
"Don't go away right yet," said Tom. "Not right yet."
"Quicker I get looking for work, quicker I'm gonna find some."
Tom studied him with half-shut eyes, and he put on his cap again.
"Look," he said, "this ain't no land of milk and honey like the preachers say. They's a mean thing here. The folks here is scared of us people coming west, and so they got cops out trying to scare us back."
"Yep," said Casey. "I know. What you ask about me being in jail for?"
Tom said slowly,
"When you're in jail, you get to kind of sensing stuff. Guys ain't let to talk a hell of a lot together. Two, maybe, but not a crowd. And so you get kind of sensey. If something's gonna bust, if, say, a fella's going stir bugs and take a crack at a guard with a mop handle, why, you know it before it happens. And if they's gonna be a break or a riot, nobody don't have to tell you. You're sensey about it. You know?"
"Yeah?"
"Stick around," said Tom. "Stick around till tomorrow anyways. Something's gonna come up. I was talking to a kid up the road, and he's being just as sneaky and wise as a dog coyote, but he's too wise. Dog coyote a-minding his own business and innocent and sweet, just having fun and no harm. Well, there's a hen roost close by."
Casey watched him intently, started to ask a question, and then shut his mouth tightly. He waggled his toes slowly, and releasing his knees, pushed out his foot so he could see it.
"Yeah," he said. "I won't go right yet."
Tom said, "When a bunch of folks, nice quiet folks, don't know nothing about nothing, something's going on."
"I'll stay," said Casey.
"And tomorrow we'll go out in the truck and look for work."
"Yeah,"
said Casey, and he waved his toes up and down and studied them gravely. Tom settled back on his elbow and closed his eyes. Inside the tent, he could hear the murmur of Rose of Sharon's voice and Connie's answering. The tarpaulin made a dark shadow, and the wedge-shaped light at each end was hard and sharp. Rose of Sharon lay on a mattress, and Connie squatted beside her.
"I ought to help Ma," Rose of Sharon said. "I tried, but every time I stirred about, I throwed up."
Connie's eyes were sullen.
"If I'd have knowed it would be like this, I wouldn't have came. I'd have studied nights about tractors back home, got me a $3 job. Fella can live awful nice on $3 a day. Go to the picture show every night, too."
Rose of Sharon looked apprehensive.
"You're going to study nights about radios," she said.
He was long in answering.
"Ain't you?"
she demanded.
"Yeah, sure, soon's I get on my feet, get a little money."
She rolled up on her elbow.
"You ain't giving it up?"
"No, no, of course not. But I didn't know there was places like this we got to live in."
The girl's eyes hardened.
"You got to," she said quietly.
"Sure, sure, I know. Got to get on my feet, get a little money. It would have been better, maybe, to stay home and study about tractors. $3 a day they get, and pick up extra money, too."
Rose of Sharon's eyes were calculating. When he looked down at her, he saw in her eyes a measuring of him, a calculation of him.
"But I'm going to study," he said, "as soon as I get on my feet."
She said fiercely, "We got to have a house before the baby comes. We ain't gonna have this baby in no tent."
"Sure," he said, "soon as I get on my feet."
He went out of the tent and looked down at Ma, crouched over the brush fire. Rose of Sharon rolled on her back and stared at the top of the tent, and then she put her thumb in her mouth for a gag, and she cried silently. Ma knelt beside the fire, breaking twigs to keep the flame up under the stew kettle. The fire flared and dropped and flared and dropped. The children, 15 of them, stood silently and watched. And when the smell of the cooking stew came to their noses crinkled slightly. The sunlight glistened on hair tawny with dust. The children were embarrassed to be there, but they did not go. Ma talked quietly to a little girl who stood inside the lusting circle. She was older than the rest. She stood on one foot, caressing the back of her leg with a bare instep. Her arms were clasped behind her. She watched Ma with steady, small gray eyes. She suggested,
"I could break up some brash if you want me, ma'am."
Ma looked up from her work.
"You want to get asked to eat, huh?"
"Yes, ma'am,"
the girl said steadily. Ma slipped the twigs under the pot, and the flame made a puttering sound.
"Didn't you have no breakfast?"
"No, ma'am. They ain't no work hereabouts. Pa's in trying to sell some stuff to get gas so's we can get along."
Ma looked up.
"Didn't none of these here have no breakfast?"
The circle of children shifted nervously and looked away from the boiling kettle. One small boy said boastfully,
"I did. Me and my brother did. And them two did 'cause I seen 'em. We et good. We're going south tonight."
Ma smiled.
"Then you ain't hungry. They ain't enough here to go around."
The small boy's lips stuck out.
"We et good," he said.
And he turned and ran and dived into a tent. Ma looked after him so long that the oldest girl reminded her,
"The fire's down, ma'am. I can keep it up if you want."
Ruthie and Winfield stood inside the circle, comporting themselves with proper frigidity and dignity. They were aloof, and at the same time possessive. Ruthie turned cold and angry eyes on the little girl. Ruthie squatted down to break up the twigs for Ma. Ma lifted the kettle lid and stirred the stew with a stick.
"I'm sure glad some of you ain't hungry. That little fella ain't, anyways."
The girl sneered.
"Oh, him. He was a braggin', high and mighty. If he don't have no supper, know what he done? Last night, come out and say they got chicken to eat. Well, sir, I looked in whilst they was a-eatin', and it was fried dough just like everybody else."
"Oh."
And Ma looked down toward the tent where the small boy had gone. She looked back at the little girl.
"How long you been in California?" she asked.
"Oh, about 6 months. We lived in a government camp a while, and then we went north, and when we come back, it was full up. That's a nice place to live, you bet."
"Where's that?"
Ma asked, and she took the sticks from Ruthie's hand and fed the fire. Ruthie glared with hatred at the older girl.
"Over by Weed Patch. Got nice toilets and baths, and you can wash clothes in a tub, and they's water right handy, good drinking water. And nights the folks plays music, and Saturday night they give a dance. Oh, you never seen anything so nice. Got a place for kids to play, and them toilets with paper. Pull down a little jigger, and the water comes right in the toilet. And they ain't no cops let to come look in your tent any time they want. And the fella runs the camp is so polite, comes a-visitin' and talks and ain't high and mighty. I wish we could go live there again."
Ma said,
"I never heard about it. I sure could use a washtub, I tell you."
The girl went on excitedly,
"Why, God Almighty, they got hot water right in pipes. And you get in under a shower bath, and it's warm. You never seen such a place."
Ma said,
"All full now, you say?" "Yeah. Last time we asked, it was."
"Must cost a lot," said Ma.
"Well, it costs, but if you ain't got the money, they let you work it out. Couple hours a week, cleaning up and garbage cans, stuff like that. And nights there's music and folks talks together and hot water right in the pipes. You never seen nothing so nice."
Ma said,
"I sure wished we could go there."
Ruthie had stood all she could. She blurted fiercely,
"Grandma died right on top of the truck."
The girl looked questioningly at her.
"Well, she did," Ruthie said, "and the coroner got her."
She closed her lips tightly and broke up a little pile of sticks. Winfield blinked at the boldness of the attack.
"Right on the truck," he echoed. "Corner stuck her in a big basket."
Ma said, "You shush now, both of you, or you got to go away." And she fed twigs into the fire. Down the line, Al had strolled to watch the valve grinding job.
"Looks like you're about through," he said.
"Two more."
"Is there any girls in this here camp?"
"I got a wife," said the young man. "I got no time for girls."
"I always got time for girls," said Al. "I got no time for nothing else."
"You get a little hungry, and you'll change." Al laughed.
"Maybe, but I ain't never changed that notion yet."
"Fella I talked to a while ago. He's with you, ain't he?"
"Yeah, my brother Tom. Better not fool with him. He killed a fella."
"Dead? What for?"
"Fight. Fella got a knife in Tom. Tom busted him with a shovel."
"Dead, huh? What'd the law do?"
"Let him off, 'cause it was a fight," said Al.
He don't look like a quarreler.
Oh, he ain't.
But Tom don't take nothing from nobody. Al's voice was very proud.
Tom, he's quiet, but look out.
Well, I talked to him. He didn't sound mean.
He ain't.
Just as nice as pie till he's roused, and then look out.
The young man ground at the last valve.
Like me to help you get them valves set and the head on?
Sure, if you got nothing else to do.
Ought to get some sleep, said Al. But hell, I can't keep my hands out of a tore-down car. Just gotta get in.
Well, I'd admire to get a hand, said the young man. My name's Floyd Knowles.
I'm Al Jode.
Proud to meet you.
Me too, said Al. Gonna use the same gasket?
Got to, said Floyd.
Al took out his pocket knife and scraped at the block.
Jesus, he said. They ain't nothing I love like the guts of an engine.
How about girls?
Yeah, girls too. Wished I could tear down a Rolls and put her back. I looked under the hood of a CAD 16 one time, and God almighty, you never seen nothing so sweet in your life. In Salisaw, and here's this 16 a-standing in front of a restaurant. So I lifts the hood, and a guy comes out and says, what the hell you doing? I says, just looking. Ain't she swell? And he just stands there. I don't think he ever looked in there before. Just stands there, rich fella in a straw hat, got a striped shirt on and eyeglasses. We don't say nothing. Just look. And pretty soon he says, how'd you like to drive her?
Floyd said,
the hell?
Sure. How'd you like to drive her? Well, hell, I got on jeans all dirty. I says, I'd get her dirty. Come on, he says, just take her around the block. Well, sir, I sat in that seat and I took her around the block 8 times and oh my God almighty.
Nice?
Floyd asked.
Oh, Jesus, said Al. If I could have tore her down, why, I'd give anything.
Floyd slowed his jerking arm. He lifted the last valve from its seat and looked at it.
You better get used to a jalopy, he said, 'cause you ain't gonna drive no 16.
He put his brace down on the running board and took up a chisel to scrape the crust from the block. 2 stocky women, bareheaded and barefooted, went by carrying a bucket of milky water between them. They limped against the weight of the bucket, and neither one looked up from the ground. The sun was half down in afternoon. Al said,
you don't like nothing much.
Floyd scraped harder with the chisel.
I've been here 6 months, he said. I've been scrabbling over this here state, trying to work hard enough and move fast enough to get meat and potatoes for me and my wife and my kids. I've run myself like a jackrabbit, and I can't quite make her. There just ain't quite enough to eat no matter what I do. I'm getting tired, that's all. I'm getting tired way past where sleep rests me, and I just don't know what to do.
Ain't there no steady work for a fella?
Al asked.
No, they ain't no steady work.
With his chisel, he pushed the crust off the block, and he wiped the dull metal with a greasy rag. A rusty touring car drove down into the camp, and there were 4 men in it, men with brown, hard faces. The car drove slowly through the camp. Floyd called to them,
any luck?
The car stopped. The driver said,
we covered a hell of a lot of ground. They ain't a hand's work in this here country. We gotta move.
Where to? Al called.
God knows. We work this here place over.
He let in the clutch and moved slowly down the camp. Al looked after him.
Wouldn't it be better if one fella went alone? Then if they was one piece of work, a fella'd get it.
Floyd put down the chisel and smiled sourly.
You ain't learned, he said. Takes gas to get round the country. Gas costs 15 cents a gallon. Them 4 fellas can't take 4 cars, so each of them puts in a dime and they get gas. You got to learn.
Al?
Al looked down at Winfield, standing importantly beside him.
Al, Ma's dishing up stew. She says, come get it.
Al wiped his hands on his trousers.
"We ain't et today," he said to Flo.